if everyone's ready now, and if you're ready, Adam, I'll hand over to you and hear what you have to say. Okay?
Okay, thank you. I think we've discussed quite a few things on these meetings, but I don't think we've dealt with the subject of human rights, which appears in the news from time to time. I mean, every time a American or British delegation visits China or Saudi Arabia, they put the human rights record of the country on the agenda. Well, it'll be the last item on the agenda, but it's there for the forum. We've also got in Strasbourg the European Court of Human Rights, and there are quite a few NGOs. I mean, the most well-known of them, I suppose, is Amnesty, which dedicated to defending human rights. But I think there's a problem for us as socialists with the concept of human rights. I mean, of course, that we don't think individuals shouldn't have free speech or shouldn't be free from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment. It's the concept of rights in general that's the problem. I mean, we're materialists, and so we don't deal in vague, abstract ideas such as justice, freedom, or rights. I mean, for us, these are reflections of material circumstances and are different in different material circumstances of the different groups of people. And we take a view that might is right. I mean, not in the sense that this is how things should be, but in the sense of how things are. Without the power to enforce it, without might, a right is just an ineffective, abstract concept. I mean, for example, take the right to strike. What this means is that it's not illegal to go on strike, but the state only made strikes legal after the workers had demonstrated that the law wasn't going to stop them striking. In other words, the state's recognition of the right to strike was the state accepting that the workers had the might to strike. But when it comes to individual rights, it's different, especially in countries which don't recognize them. I mean, when Amnesty criticizes the lack of human rights in China or Burma, or whatever it's called, or Iran or whatever, they are merely appealing to an abstract idea since there's no might to back them up. And it's no wonder that the government's concerned don't take much notice of these appeals. I mean, unless that is they want to make a gesture in order to obtain some diplomatic advantage. I mean, the most that we as materialists can accept regarding the concept of rights is of it as a description of what is in the legal code and practice of some state. In other words, as a description of what the law actually says, rather than as an abstract idea existing independently of the law. So we can say that that the right to free speech or the right to a fair trial, etc., these exist in a country when they're provided for in the legislation and the procedures of that country. On the other hand, if the law or the practice in China or wherever else doesn't allow for free speech, then this means that as a matter of objective fact, no right to free speech exists there. I mean, any other definition of rights than what is set out in the law creates all sorts of problems, not least as to what exactly they are. I mean, most people would associate human rights with free speech and freedom from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment. Why are they just restricted to things like that? Why, for instance, isn't it considered a human right to have enough food or to be housed decently? I mean, on what basis, in fact, is something considered to be a human right? I mean, in the end, it can only come down to a question of preference or political preference. It's what people making the claim consider desirable, not something objective that can be discovered. It's an expression of what they think is right, nothing more. I mean, after all, the United States Constitution includes bearing arms, keeping and bearing arms to be a human right. All the same, the human rights or the rights of man, as Tom Paine entitled his famous 1791 polemic in defense of the French Revolution, they do have a history. and it's worth looking at. So it will show what originally human rights were when the concept was first introduced. So for this, we need to go back to the end of the 18th century, when two key documents were adopted within 2 years of each other. And the first was the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen by the National Assembly of France in 1789, and the second was the first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States of America, known as the Bill of Rights, that was ratified in 1791. I'll quote from the French document, I mean, translation of the French document. In the first article is, men are born and remain free and equal in rights. The second one says, the aim of every political association is the preservation of the natural and imprescriptible rights of man. These rights are liberty, property, safety, and resistance to oppression. And the other rights, which are basically the same in the two documents, which of course isn't an accident, since there was a cross-fertilization of ideas between both sides of the Atlantic. So the other list of rights are individual has a right to free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment, and a fair trial before an impartial jury. There's one difference. The French document says, as I just said, something about the source of a government's authority being the nation composed of men who are born and always continue free and equal in respect of their rights, which governments should not infringe. In America, this had been included in an earlier document, of course, the American Declaration of Independence. You all recognize it, but I'll read it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted amongst men, delivering just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, most people would associate human rights with free speech and freedom from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment. Why are they, restricted to just these things? But all this talk in these two documents, the American Declaration of Independence and the French Declaration of Human and Civic Rights, they talk of these emanating from the nation and governing with the consent of the government. You might be led to the conclusion that the right to vote, in other words, the right to have a say in who makes the government, would be regarded as a basic human right. There's some vague reference to this in the French document, and nothing at all in the American Bill of Rights. Now, both the American and the French revolutions were revolutions carried out largely by, but in any event, in the interests of property owners, large and small, who wanted to remove the obstacles to their accumulating more property. And this does not mean that they were minority revolutions in the sense of not enjoying popular support. In America, until as late as 1829, majority of the population were independent property owners of one kind or another, farmers, artisans, and small shopkeepers. But there were conflicts between the larger and smaller property owners, between what in France were called the bourgeoisie and the petty bourgeoisie. And one of these disputes between them was precisely over the right to vote. I mean, the same issue had come up during the English Revolution of a century or so earlier, at the famous debates in the Parliamentary Army in Putney in 1647, which opposed Cromwell and the Levellers. Now, this wasn't conducted in terms of natural rights. It was more like the rights of freeborn Englishmen. And Cromwell wanted to restrict the vote to well-off freeholders and Freeman of various manufacturing and trading corporations. Now the levelers, who incidentally didn't call themselves levelers, that's what they were called. They were accused of wanting to give the vote to every adult male. But the levelers protested, no, we don't. We agree that the vote should not be given to servants or beggars. In other words, those who worked for a wage and those who had received alms from the poor law or who were beggars. It was estimated that at the time over 50% of the male population, perhaps as much as 60%, fell into this category. So what even the levelers wanted was that all property owners, however small or poor, should be given the vote, which, as I said, was just about 50% of the population. I mean, Cromwell won. I mean, his might was right, but not that it made much difference, since eventually he went on to rule without Parliament. When the richer property owners, what the richer property owners were afraid of, was that as they were not in the majority in the electorate, the less well-off majority would vote to take away their property. Now, in the debate, there's a contribution from somebody with the appropriate name of Colonel Rich, and this is what he argued. If the master and servant shall be equal electors, then clearly those that have no interest in the kingdom will make it their interest to choose those that have no interest. It may happen that the majority may, by law, not in a confusion, destroy property. There may be a law enacted that there shall be an equality of goods and estate. Unfounded fear, as it turned out. But that was the sort of issue that was discussed. The franchise question came up at the Constitutional Convention in America in 1787, which drew up the US Constitution. Now, here they opted for a different solution to prevent an anti-rich majority getting its way. They left each state to decide who to give the vote to in elections to the House of Representatives, but provided for an indirectly elected Senate. In order to make it difficult for an anti-rich majority to appear there, only a third of the senators were to be renewed at the two yearly elections. The senators were to be elected by the members of the state legislatures and not by popular vote. In fact, it's only since 1913 that senators have been directly elected. And similarly, the president was not to be elected directly, but indirectly by electors voted for by the enfranchised population of each state. I mean, this is still the situation formally and explains, you know, anomalies like Trump beating Clinton in 2016. Clinton got more of the popular vote. The same thing had happened in the 2000 presidential election when Al Gore got more popular votes than George Bush. Now, just as an aside, the United States Constitution contained an even more glaring infringement of the rights of man proclaimed by the Revolution. It accepted slavery, even if only shamefacedly. A state's representation in the House of Representatives was fixed by the number of free persons living there, plus two-fifths of other persons, in other words, slaves. Not only were slaves denied the rights set out in the Bill of Rights, but they were only considered to be 40% human. In France, the constitution that was eventually drawn up by the same assembly that had proclaimed the rights of man and citizen, including that men are born and always continue free and equal in respect to their rights, excluded some 40% of the male population from voting. The free and equal citizens were divided into two categories, active, with the vote, and passive, without the vote, based on property and income. But even the active citizens didn't vote directly for the members of the National Assembly, but only for the electors. To be an elector, you had to have an even higher taxpaying qualification, who then elected the deputies, for whom there was an even higher qualification. So both in America and France, arrangements were made to keep power out of the hands of the majority and in the hands of the richer property owners. This is one of the reasons why we call these revolutions bourgeois revolutions. It was and it was these bourgeois revolutions that first proclaimed the rights of man, now known as human rights. The most that could be said was that these things, the things that they did accept, which, you know, the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and so on, freedom from arbitrary arrest, fair trial, that they accepted these as the rights of man, they were to apply to all men and women, irrespective of whether or not they had the vote. This is still the only human rights that organisations like Amnesty are concerned with. The Marxists who have analysed these bourgeois revolutions, who explain the rights of man as an ideology accompanying the development of the market economy, which these revolutions both reflected and encouraged. On the market, especially the ideal free competitive market, all commodity producers are equal in the sense of the market not according the many special privileges, any of the many special privileges. They're all free agents in the sense of making their own decisions independently of each other about what and how much to produce and sell. And the market, which is the outcome of these decisions of the free and equal commodity producers, operates independently of the government. So hence it's the duty of the government to accept that all men are equal as long as they are property owners, in other words, commodity producers of some sort. Now, some might find this to be a crude economic determinism, but I think it holds up. The 18th century rights of man were really the rights of independent commodity producers. This is not to say that those who struggled for a government accountable to them and respecting certain norms were insincere hypocrites, though they must have been aware of the economic advantage for them if they were successful. I mean, look at the long list of economic complaints contained in the United States Declaration of Independence. I mean, perhaps, I don't know, they probably just thought that God was on their side and wouldn't necessarily have a complicated a philosophy about it. However, those that did, as I mentioned, the levelers, Thomas Jefferson, Tom Paine, Robespierre, held ideas about the ideal society, which were basically similar. That would be a republic of small-scale producers working on their own account, with none being either too rich or too poor. I mean, this corresponds to what Marx would have called simple commodity production, where there's production for the market, but where exchange is not to obtain more money, but to obtain needed, useful things that the producers cannot produce themselves. I mean, such a society never existed, though the nearest to it probably would be in New England and Pennsylvania in the 18th century. But the society that these revolutions were ushering in, which had already developed to some extent, was not Marx's simple commodity production, but capitalism, where there was still production for the market, but where the aim of exchange was now not essentially to acquire useful things, but to acquire money. In other words, there was production for profit, and where there were rich and poor, and an increasing number of people without property or prospect, any prospect of acquiring any, and forced to work for wages. A fate which was to await most of the small commodity producers championed by Jefferson and Robespierre. I mean, this form of developed commodity production too had its philosopher in John Locke, who justified unequal property ownership and even slavery. I mean, his argument was it was better to be a slave than dead. It was eventually people whose views were similar to Locke who took over and directed the revolutions in America and France, which made them, as I said, bourgeois revolution, as opposed to, I suppose, petty bourgeois revolution. It's, in fact, to move nearer to present day, I mean, it's not only Marxists who associate human rights with the market economy, so do advocates of the free market. I mean, in America, there's a free market think tank called the Cato Institute, and they brought out a document, I think, opposing trade sanctions against China for its bad human rights record on the grounds that the right to trade freely was also a human right. I think the association of human rights and political democracy generally with the market economy and private property is that's the official policy of the United States government. And when it criticizes the human rights record of China, Syria, Iran, North Korea, what is it criticizing is not so much the imprisonment of dissidents as the fact that these countries have state-run economies which don't allow U.S. corporations free access to invest and to buy and sell goods, to trade. And that the United States uses human rights to try to impose its form of capitalism on other countries must be an embarrassment to organizations such as Amnesty, who are interested in these rights for their own sake. I mean, it allows the governments they criticize to dismiss them as tools of the United States and Western foreign policy. I suppose that objectively, even if of course quite unintentionally, they are. But this wouldn't be the criticism that we can make of organizations like Amnesty. And we criticize them for having set their sights too low. I mean, in confining themselves to only taking up individual cases, they are missing the big picture. I mean, there's nothing wrong with writing to prisoners, any prisoner, not just political prisoners, and taking up their case with the authorities. I'm sure the prisoners concerned are grateful for this, and it helps ease their lot a bit. But this could hardly be called political. You might even call it sub-political. I would, of course, like organizations like Amnesty and the others involved in this sort of humanitarian work to work for socialism, or even to work for the coming of political democracy to those countries without it, because this is the best condition under capitalism for the development of a socialist movement. But the various human rights organizations have deliberately chosen not to do this. This is not just because it would close all channels of communication with the political authorities they have to deal with. If they're going to have any chance of achieving something in individual cases, take up. I mean, if they criticize their politics, they wouldn't get a hearing. It's also because either implicitly or explicitly they regard working with something bigger, such as political democracy, let alone socialism, as too unrealistic a goal in the sense of something not likely to be achieved in the near future. And human rights organizations are not the only ones to take up this position, but in the last 40 to 50 years or so, it's become the general position of people concerned about some problem or other thrown up by capitalism. In the past, such people would have joined the Labour Party or the Communist Party to try to solve these problems by national political action. Now they've given up on this and dispersed into hundreds, maybe thousands of single issue organizations, Amnesty, Shelter, Greenpeace, Child Poverty Action, etc., etc. It is as if they've accepted that capitalism is here to stay, and they've adopted the tactic of merely trying to make things a little less hard in the field of their particular concern. And it's a reflection, I think, of the pessimism that resulted from the failure of reformism, in which so many people had previously placed such high hopes. And that no doubt such people gain some satisfaction when they make progress in a particular individual case, but can they really be satisfied with the prospect of endlessly having to fight such cases again and again? And can they really be happy seeing the future as capitalism continue forever, with them trying to stop it stamping so hard on people? Hopefully not. Hopefully they will eventually come round to realizing that it makes more sense to work for a world in which there'll be no violation of human rights in their sense, since there'll be no governments representing the interests of minority ruling classes with an interest in violating them to protect their privileges and rule. In other words, a classless, stateless world based on the common ownership and democratic control of the means of life by the interest of all the people. In such a socialist world, the whole concept of human rights would not be needed, since free speech and the rest would automatically exist as a matter of course. I mean, they'd be part of the inbuilt democratic nature of society, either as procedural rules or spontaneous behavior patterns. There'd be no minority ruling class or armed political center against which people would need protection. People would be in charge of their own collective destiny. They're not going to restrict it, restrict their own freedoms. And when the the means of production are owned by all in common, when everybody has an equal say in the way things are run, who is going to want to suppress free speech and the other things that go under the name of human rights? What would be the incentive to do this? We'd be no more need laws to protect against this than we would need laws against adulterating food in a society based on serving human welfare. It just wouldn't occur to anyone to want to do anything that went against this. Okay, Chair, thanks. That's it. That's the introduction.